So we're back to Mishlei. Mishlei, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Dalet. We'll hopefully finish the Perek today. We've got 10 Pesukim to go. Okay? We have some fun stuff, as you can see the title. The Price of the Fool in a Foxhole. You'll see what that means as we go on forward. So if you remember last week, we spoke about how, or not last week, 2 weeks ago, Shlomo HaMelech is basically saying, I'm giving you all of my wisdom. It's your job to take it, right? If you remember, sort of one of our last messages was the first 50% is on the quarterback and the second 50% is on the receiver. Shlomo HaMelech's done his part. He's thrown the pass. The question is if you're going to receive it. And we talked about the people that don't want to receive it, the people that would prefer to do nothing. We said, Chachmos Bachutz Tarona, right? Shlomo HaMelech says that the wisdom is outside, you know, just for everyone to come and get. They sit at the head of the gates, and what do the other people do in response to these people that are trying to seduce innocent, vulnerable people? So these people, what do? Psayim and tavu pesi. The simpletons, they love being simple, right? We said last time, ignorance is bliss. They live by that notion. They don't just benefit from it, right? Veleitzim latzon chamdulahem, and the mockers, they mock. They enjoy mocking. The chsilim yisnudas, and the fools, they prefer to hate wisdom. And then we said, we ended off last time, tashuvu tochachti, you know, return to my rebuke. Hinei abi alachem ruchi, I'm giving you everything I got. Odia devari aschem, I'm giving you all of my knowledge. So that's where we left off. And the interesting beginning, or the, sort of the interesting next step, is what do the people do in response? Meaning, we'll do a couple more examples of things that Shlomo HaMelech is asking of them. But now it's going to specifically say what did they do, right? So first, it categorized them. It said the simpletons, they love to be simple, and the fools, they love to hate wisdom. But now the question is, what did they do with Shlomo HaMelech's wisdom? They didn't speak specifically to what Shlomo HaMelech is saying. It just said that they don't like these things. So now if you look at Pasuk Chaf Dalet, so Shlomo HaMelech says the following, Yan karasi vatima'inu. I called out, even though I called out, right, how is it translated on the sheets? Since you refused me when I called. Yan karasi vatima'inu. Because when I called out, you refused me. Natisi yadi v'ein makshiv. I reached out my hand and you didn't pay heed. Batifru kolatzasi, and you have disregarded my advice. Vesochachti lo avisem, and my rebuke you don't enjoy or you don't want. So then that's the first clause of the statement, obviously. Because you did X, Y, Z, then I'm going to do this. But first, let's focus a little bit on what they didn't do. There are four clauses to this section. If you look closely, so you have, Yan karasi vatzma'ini, I called out and you refused. Natisi yadi v'ein makshiv, that's number two. I reached out my hand, you didn't listen. Tifru etz kol hasasi, and you disregarded my advice. V'tochachti lo avisam, that's number four. And my rebuke, you did not heed, you didn't hear, you didn't want. Really, Rashi says you didn't want. Quickly, yeah.
Quickly. Tochacha.
Yeah.
Hashem.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to give tochacha if you know or believe the person is not going to listen to you.
Okay, so he's...
And then Hashem obviously knew what...
How do you know what happened here?
I know we didn't listen.
How do you know? I don't know. This, first of all, Shlomo HaMelech is speaking in theoretical terms, right? He's not talking to anyone specifically. He's talking to a general class of people. So when he's explaining that, so he's not giving specifics of halacha, so it obviously wouldn't fall into that category. But just keep in mind, that is a relevant halacha. Whether or not someone's going to listen to your rebuke is going to dictate whether or not you would say it. But it's not relevant here, because we're speaking in theory. So, first clause, Yan karasi vatzmein. What does it mean to call out to somebody? So notice that this is very non-specific. Shlomo HaMelech is not saying, I'm giving you chachma. He's not saying, I'm giving you wisdom. He's not saying, I'm giving you advice. This first clause is just, Yan karasi vatzma'ini. I called out and you refused me. This means to call out. Basically, he's saying, I'm here for you, right? I'm here. I'm willing to call out for you. And then he says, Natisi yadi v'ein makshiv. I reached out my hand. Again, reaching out your hand is not specific. What are these two clauses?
Can you say, I'm going to help you?
What do you mean?
I want your help. Or
I want to help you, you mean?
I want you to ask me for help. I'm here.
Right. Okay, good. That's where I'm going. Good. So the next pasuk is very different from this. The first pasuk is very general. It doesn't say exactly what he's asking, what he's telling them. But then the next pasuk, Vatifru as kol hatzasi, you've disregarded my etza. Etza is a very specific thing. It's advice to help somebody, you're giving them practical tips. We'll get to it in a second. What Rashi tells us, but v'toch achti lo avisem is also very specific. I'm rebuking you for doing something wrong. Right, so the second pasuk is more specific than the first. The first pasuk, I'm calling out to you. It doesn't say what he's calling out for. I'm reaching out to you. It doesn't say what he's reaching out to do. Just very, very general. And then the second pasuk is more specific. So now let's break down the two clauses in each of the steps. The first clause, if we're going to explain it, or each of the first step, the two clauses in the first step, we can say are very general. They're basically Shlomo Melech reaching out to support. They're saying, I'm here for you. Right, as Reina was saying, Karasi, I'm calling out to you. I'm here. If you need help, I'm here. And then you can see that really more clearly in Natisi Yadi, that I'm reaching out my hand. So there are different Mefarshim go about the hand in different ways. Some people say that Natisi Yadi means he's motioning them over. Come here. I can help you. I'd like to interpret it as being reaching out my hand to help you. Right, to show you that I'm physically engaged in helping you, whatever your situation is. What it seems to me is that the two categories in the first step are verbal and nonverbal communication. That oftentimes some people are helped when you reach out to them, you give them a phone call, you talk to them, you work through their issues, you're able to discern what they're going through, you're able to analyze it with them just by talking. And then there are other times where talking and analyzing and comprehending and explaining and dialogue is not going to help. Another type of support, which is not necessarily verbal, but is nonverbal. You're giving a pat on the back. You're giving them a hug. You're showing the empathy in your eyes. So that's nonverbal communication. Both of those strategies, Shlomo HaMelech is saying, I tried both of these. I tried to talk to you. I tried to call out to you. I tried to tell you I'm here. You didn't want it. And then Natisi Yadi. I reached out my hand. I tried to use nonverbal communication. Both of them didn't work. Right? You refused my verbal communication, my verbal support, then you refused my physical support or my nonverbal support. Those are two ways he tried to reach out. And then, you disregarded my etza. What's etza? Rashi tells us, I don't have it on the sheet. I gave you practical tips to help you. Rashi says, "Legadel eschem," to make you better in the world. Legadel etchem, to help you grow, to make you bigger, to make you greater, right? And that you also disregarded. V'tochachti, in my rebuke, you didn't want. So what's the two clauses here? Now we're getting into specifics. What are the actual lessons he's trying to teach them? Number one, things that can help them proactively, to tell them do X, Y, and Z, and your life will become better. You will be greater in the world. And number two is tochachti, my rebuke. I see that you're doing something wrong. You should stop doing that thing that's wrong. Right? So it's the ase tov. You should do these things to do well. And it's the sor meira. You should not do these things in order to make sure that you're okay, that you're protected, and you don't get punished. So each four of these clauses have very important ramifications in terms of how we reach out to people. As I said before, sometimes people need verbal support. Some people need nonverbal support. And some people need to be explained, what are the tips to do better? What are the tips to stay away from? And when it comes to these two ideas, so let's go a little bit deeper through Dale Carnegie. Dale Carnegie wrote a very well-known book. I don't know if it's, I don't know where it ranks on the seller's list or whatever, but it's called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Probably something he might have seen Proverbs and taken some pages out of that book. So what are some of the things he says? So just a couple quotes from that book. Actions speak louder than words, and a smile says, I like you, you make me happy, I'm glad to see you. That's why dogs make such a hit. They're so glad to see us, they almost jump out of their skins, so naturally, we are glad to see them. That when you give someone nonverbal communication, that's one of the greatest ways to influence someone. When you're willing to give over, to transmit the message on your body, through your body, that you want someone there, so they'll reciprocate in kind. And he called, I think, the continuation of this piece, he talks about the influence of babies and how babies always make people happier, and a smile, and the baby smile, and he has some interesting anecdote about going into a doctor's office and everyone's just mopey and sad, and then all of a sudden a woman comes in with a baby and a little cat, and everybody's just changes the mood completely. So there's something about nonverbal communication which is contagious. So that's number one. That's the yan, that's the natisi yadi velo v'ein makshiv. I reached out my hand, I tried nonverbal communication, and even that didn't work. And then similarly, as we said before, continuing from there, what he says about Tifri was called Tassi Rashi says, not that I tried to tell you what I think is good, but rather I tried to tell you what's good for you. Right? Rashi had said that, as I quoted before, Sheya'atzi legado eschem. I'm doing this for your own good. These are things that are good for you. So in another place in the book, I'll be honest, I didn't read the whole book. I just saw some excerpts. And he said, personally, I'm very fond of strawberries and cream. This is what Dale Carnegie says. But I found that for some strange reason, fish prefer worms. So when I went fishing, I didn't think about what I wanted. I thought about what they wanted. I didn't bait the hook with strawberries and cream. Rather, I dangled a worm or a grasshopper in front of the fish and said, wouldn't you like to have that? Why not use the same common sense when fishing for people? Now, obviously, that sounds very sort of simplistic when you think about it in terms of fish. But the truth is, we fail in this area all the time. There's a famous study, but one of the Heath books that I always mention, I didn't get around to quoting it here. He talks about what people get for people's weddings on their registry. You ever heard of this? When you get things for people off of their register. So everyone, when they get married, Baruch Hashem, they're able to go to Bed Bath & Beyond or to Macy's or all these places, and you get to have fun with the laser gun, right? You shoot, I want this, I want that, I want that thing, and then hopefully it all comes up onto your registry, and when someone gets married, and when they finally get married, someone looks at their registry to see what they want. So what's interesting is, when you ask the people who are getting married what they want, so obviously they're going to say we want what's on the registry. And when you ask them if they want something that's not on their registry, so they're obviously upset about it. And that's unanimous. Like, no one wants things that are not on their registry. And yet, the statistics of what people actually get for others that are not on their registry is like 50% more. 50% more people get things that are off of the registry than what are on the registry, even though everyone agrees that they only want what's on the registry. So why is that? So the obvious answer is that when we look for a gift for somebody else, we're obviously restrained, we're constrained to what we believe is a good gift. Right? And I'm sure everyone has their own examples of this in their own life, whether it's a son or yourselves, who you said you wanted one thing and you got something completely different. You had to go bring it back to Bed Bath & Beyond, schlep it back in your car, and then you had to buy something else from Bed Bath & Beyond instead of, I mean, now they give store credit. It used to be you can get cash, fine. Depends on the Bed Bath & Beyond you go to.
So cash isn't on the list.
Cash apparently is not on the list, no. But it should be. So this concept applies in many different ways. Even though it's very simplistic, we subjugate ourselves to our own desires even when we're helping somebody else. We know we like something, so let's get that for somebody else. Wow. Even when they tell us what they want.
Why don't you think, like, just simplistically in a logical way and say, all right, I'll get what the person wants on the register.
You would think that. You would think that. And yet, Mirz Hashem, you'll find out that people get you other things too. From the same store. It's not like they went to like a different store. I just happened to be in this other store. You didn't have a register. They'll get stuff from Bed Bath & Beyond that wasn't on your registry, as if you didn't see it when you walked through the store.
Yeah, but could it also be that you do have more knowledge than they do with your Fletchers?
That's what you think.
They really don't need it.
That's how you justify it. Yeah, that's how you justify it to yourself. But like, lo and behold.
There's a bunch of work between her and me.
Okay, I don't. If you need any counseling, you let me know. Okay. But to then talk about the last point, tochachti lo avisem, my rebuke you didn't want. Here it translated as, you would not hear my rebuke. Okay, same thing. There's an interesting story they say about the Sfas Emes. I quoted this a couple weeks ago in our Pshischa on the Parsha. And this is something that really not going to help us understand this line any better, but will give us a little bit more chizuk in terms of understanding where Shlomo is coming from. This is a different version of the same story that I said a couple weeks ago, but still a relevant one. The first Ger Rebbe was a Chiddush Arim. The second Ger Rebbe, not technically, but practically, the second Ger Rebbe was the Sfas Emes. He wasn't his son, but he was his grandson. Sfas Emes' father passed away when he was very young. Sfas Emes passed away when he was a child, and his grandfather raised him. He was an Eloi, a prodigy, an apple of his grandfather's eyes. One night, when he was still a young boy, the Sfas Emes learned with his chavrusa straight through the night. He nodded off right before Shacharis, resting his head on the Gemara. After a few minutes, he awoke with a start. I don't know what that means. He washed his hands and hurried to shul, but he was already a little late. After Shacharis, the Chiddush Arim, his grandfather, called him over. "What's this with coming late to Shacharis?" he said in a sharp tone. "It's bad enough for yourself, but think how it will affect others. The grandson of the Rebbe can come late. What kind of example is that for the boys or even men? It's a chilul Hashem, a desecration of Hashem's name, no less." The Chiddush Arim went on in this vein for a few minutes, but the Sfas Emes did not even say a word in his own defense. He could have argued that it had been an accident. He'd stayed up all night learning Torah, and that sleep had overcome him at the end for just a few minutes, but he remained silent. A little while later, his chavrusa, the Sfas Emes, asked him, "Why didn't you say anything to defend yourself? You were innocent. Why were you silent?" When a great man gives you mussar, says the Sfas Emes, it's worthwhile to listen, even if you don't deserve it. Even if you're completely innocent, I wanted to hear my grandfather's mussar. So this is what the Sfas Emes says to the Chiddush Arim. I want to hear mussar. I had the opportunity to hear someone tell me how to be a better person. I'm not going to waste that opportunity. So it's interesting, I find, about this story, at least the way that Rabbi Friend tells it over, is that the Sfas Emes says, even if you're completely innocent. Oftentimes, what I find when someone gives you mussar is, even if you're not completely innocent, you try to convince yourself that you're completely innocent, as if to defend yourself from whatever the rebuke you're getting. Right? So here, tochachti lo avisem, you didn't want my rebuke. Shlomo Melech is saying, I was rebuking you, but you didn't want it. And as we said last time with the word chinam, oftentimes they think that we did something, but no consequences, fine. Whatever we did, we're going to get away with it. There's no problem with what we did. But Shlomo HaMelech is saying, no, tochachti lo avisem, you didn't want it. You should want it. You should want my rebuke, even if you think you're innocent. Sfas Emes knew he was innocent. But kal vachomer us, when it comes to us receiving and accepting rebuke, we should all keep in mind the story of Sfas Emes and the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech, tochachti lo avisem, that we should always want rebuke. Assuming that it's done in a nice way. Someone scolding you, not for rebuke, but a power play, so that's not the same thing.
It's like the Mashiach, the Tanoim, who said, "I want to be here at the time of Mashiach, but I'm so afraid of the punishment that bad things are going to happen
before." Okay.
I don't want to be around.
Okay, interesting. I don't know if that's the exact same thing, but it's an interesting Gemara. So then Shlomo Melech says, so then this is what happens. These four clauses. Shlomo Melech said, I did A, B, C, and D. You didn't want any of them. We talked about each category. And because of that, says Shlomo Melech, Gam ani be'edchem eschak el'ag bevo pachtachem. How's it translate? I will laugh at your calamity and mock when terror comes upon you. Sounds like a very kind of not nice thing to do. Right, I'm going to mock you when it comes to your calamity. So why is Shlomo Melech saying this? Because he's responding in kind to the people he already introduced. If you look back, we reviewed it today. If one were to look back at Pasuk Chaf Bet, so he says, "Admasai b'sayim tevu pasi v'leitzim lasan chem dulahem." The simpletons want simplicity, and the leitzim. What are the leitzim? The mockers. They love to mock. So comes Shlomo Melech and says, "Gam, I also am going to mock. If you're going to mock me when I'm trying to help you, so I'm going to mock you when you want me to help you." Elag bevo b'achtachem. What's interesting about this pasuk is it sounds like it's repeating itself, right? Stuart's not here, but he pointed this out last time. Oftentimes it sounds like parallel phrasing that we're saying the same thing over again. But the truth is that these two things are very different. The Malbim explains. Do I have the Malbim here? Yeah. The Malbim explains source number 6. Gam ani be'edchem eschak. Ha'ed, this aid, this calamity, hi hatzara atzma. That's the actual calamity itself. V'ha'pachad, hu lifnei hatzara. The fear that a person has is before the calamity strikes. And then he writes this in parentheses. I love this parentheses. Shegeder hapachad. What are the parameters of fear? How do you define fear? Hapachad hu midavar she'enu yodea mima mefchad. Mefached. That's when do you have fear? You only have fear when you're imagining something that's going to come in the future. You don't even know what to be afraid of. Right? You heard on the news that there's going to be a terrible tornado. So now you're afraid. Now, you think there's going to be a tornado, but you don't actually know there's going to be a tornado. You don't know if it's going to hit you, if it's not going to hit you. It could be the neighborhood over. It could not happen at all. Right? A few weeks ago, we had that siren in the middle of Kabbalah Shabbos. Never happens. Right? So sometimes, or usually, the nature of fear is such that it's always going to be before it happens. When it happens, that's not fear anymore. That's pain. That's struggle. That's difficulty. But fear always only comes before it happens. And oftentimes, because it comes beforehand, we restrict ourselves. There's a word I'm looking for, obviously. We paralyze ourselves or we cripple ourselves. We cripple ourselves in what we want to do because of the fear. And what's interesting is oftentimes the fear is way overrated, right? The fear, we way overweigh our fear for whatever's going to come up, right? Where the fear of anticipation is much greater than what actually ends up happening, right? It's the fear of the unknown. And I borrowed some of these concepts from a Rabbi Daniel Friedman. I don't know if people know Rabbi Daniel Friedman. A little young, not as young as I am, but he's in New Jersey. He's a rabbi there. He's a rabbi at TABC, if people know the school. He's also a rabbi at a shul there. But he says that when he said this malbim, so he quoted from FDR's first inaugural address. Right, I'm certain that my fellow Americans, right, this is in the 1930s, the throes of the Depression. I'm certain my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impel. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. Right? Because we're so afraid of what's going to be, we stop ourselves from doing anything now. Right? We're so overtaken with fear of what could happen, which we don't know for sure is going to happen. Right? As he says, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror. But it paralyzes the needed efforts now. Right? We want to be able to do things, but we're so afraid what's going to happen if we do them. So he says, needed efforts are rejected. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days. So basically he says, I'm going to tell it like it is, not like we're afraid it's going to be. Right? That's his whole message, that we can't paralyze ourselves in the present for the fear of what's going to be in the future. Because you can't be so afraid that it's going to prevent you from doing things later on. And that's when Shlomo Melch says here, Gam ani bi'edchem eschak el ag bevo pachtechem. When your fear comes, what does that mean, when your fear comes? When it comes to fruition, you're so busy right now worrying about what's going to be happening because you see the terror coming. So, bevo pachtechem, I'm also not going to help you. Right now, you're reaching out because you're afraid of what's going to be. But ani be'edchem eschak. At the time you're terror, I'm going to be laughing. And at the time you're worrying about the terror that's coming, I'm also going to be laughing. Or I'm going to be mocking, I'm not going to be helping you. Sounds a little harsh, but again, he's responding to the perspective of these people beforehand. And then he continues. In a similar vein, he ends this next pasuk. Bevo kishoa pachtechem ve'edchem kesufa yasa bevo aleichem tzara v'tzuka. When terror comes like a disaster, like a shoa, and calamity arrives like a whirlwind, when trouble and distress come upon you. What's the difference between trouble and distress? tzara v'tzuka. We say it in Achinu also, right? Mikol tzara v'tzuka, mikol nego machala, right? What's the difference between tzara and tzuka? So tzara is a disaster of some kind. The Malbim explains in source number 9, Bevoa alechem tzara v'tzuka, shetzara hi hatzara hachitzonis. Tzara, a calamity, a disaster, is something that happens on the outside. That's a tornado. That's the stock market crashing. Right? Those are things that happen externally. And what's tzuka? V'tzuka hi tzukas hanefesh hapenimis. Anyone want to guess what that word is in the parentheses? What? In source number 9, I thought for a moment it might have been English, but I don't think it is, just because I can't figure it out. It might be paralyzing. I don't know. Is it Yiddish? Parts of flying. I don't know. Parts of flying.
I can ask my cousin. Tell you.
Maybe it's related to tzefloigen. It looks like it's related to tzefloigen. Means you're all messed up in the head, right? You're all like confused or whatever. So maybe it looks like there's some letters are related to the word tzefloigen. So maybe it's related. I don't know. Pritza Floygen. I don't know. I have to work on my Yiddish. She'im yilaves hatzara chitzonis. And therefore, because there are two elements, there's the calamity on the outside, and then there's the stress on the inside, even when yilaves hatzara chitzonis, even when you take away the terrible thing that happened on the outside, sukas hanefesh hira umar ma'od, she'azavad kotzik v'vyachom yisaj legamre. Even if the thing on the outside is gone, you're still going to be feeling stressed on the inside. And if everyone's ever felt this, something very bad happens, something very unfortunate happens, and even after that thing is all cleaned up, you need like time to decompress, right? You need time to just, you know, relax and get your mind somewhere else. You know, oftentimes something happens, you know, to me or whatever, and it's very difficult, so oftentimes I need like a nap to just reset my mind. Because I can't stop thinking about it, my blood pressure is still up, and you know, your whole persona has changed. Even after the external threat is gone, you still have the tzuka, you still have the internal problem. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech is saying to them. Bevok shoach b'hachtachem. When that thing comes, ve'edchem kesufa yasa, that calamity, that disaster is going to come, and it's going to be all-encompassing. Bevo aleichem tzara, it's going to be on the outside, and tzuka, it's going to be on the inside. But what have we learned about the inside? We say here, the Malbim said, the inside is worse than the outside. The outside is going to, you know, it's going to come, it's going to go. Anything that comes is going to go at some point. But the Malbim says the inside, what's going on internally, psychologically, emotionally, morally, whatever's going on the inside, that's going to have a lasting effect. He says, Shlomo HaMelech, we've already seen this before. How can you make sure you can deal with that internal problem, with that psychological issue? We said in a couple weeks ago, Kilvias chen heim l'roshecha v'anakim l'gargar osecha. They, this wisdom that I'm giving over to you, it's a wreath upon your head. We said, what does it mean? It's a wreath upon your head. We had mentioned from the Rabbeinu Yonah that it's tov l'tzvun asecha. What did that mean, tov l'tzvun asecha? It was good for your own psychology. We said from one of the Heath brothers, I think, maybe a different book, I don't remember anymore, the analogy of weightlifting. You remember this analogy? The math teacher who would tell his students, who asked him, what do we need to know all this math for? Right? And he said to them, when you go in the gym and you're weightlifting, are you expecting someone to come torture you with a barbell? No. No one puts a barbell on top of you and says, now hopefully your training will pay off. No. People are going to hurt you. You're going to require strength in some other fashion, which is why you use and you lift barbells, because you're going to need to use that muscle again. So the same thing is true with math. When it comes to math, you're not going to need, you know, advanced calculus, probably, unless you go into one of those fields. But you are going to need to use your brain. You are going to need to be able to comprehend, to analyze, to figure out solutions for problems. So the math teacher would say to his students, this is why we learn math, not necessarily for the math itself. Just like the weightlifter doesn't use it for the barbell itself, but for the situation he's going to need it for later. Similarly, says Rabbeinu Yonah, Levias chen heim l'roshecha. All this wisdom that Shlomo Melech says he's giving over, it's good for your head. It's Levias chen l'roshecha. It's a graceful wreath upon your head, because later on in life, maybe it won't be the case that you need to know the Aleph Beis in order. Right? Maybe it won't be the case that when, you know, all the stuff you learned in elementary school in terms of the Chumash and Avram and Yitzchak and all the stories in Tanakh, maybe you're not going to need to know that. Maybe you're not going to necessarily go into a Torah bowl and have to figure it all out. But one day you're going to have situations where you're going to need moral clarity. You're going to need some kind of ethical vision about how to deal with a situation, how to make up the mistake that you did. You're going to have to know this sort of the ethical knowledge, the moral knowledge that Shlomo HaMelech gives over in order to deal with these situations. So here says Shlomo HaMelech, the Tzar of Itzuka, you know how you're supposed to get out of the Tzar of Itzuka? The Tzar is going to take care of itself. The tornado is going to pass. But the Tzuka, that's about whether or not you've built up that formidable knowledge, that formidable character on the inside. That's what I'm trying to tell you. When it comes the day, you're going to have a Tzara. The question is how much of a Tzuka you're also going to have. The Tzara is going to pass. But the tzuka is up to you. How much on the inside are you going to have to deal with it? That's about whether or not you've taken all my wisdom in. And this reminded me, of course, of sort of the greatest psychologist in terms of dealing with pain and overcoming struggles in the last century, at least, Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl, A Man's Search for Meaning. I have another book from him I haven't started yet, which is also Ultimate Meaning or something like that. Maybe people are familiar with it. Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning. I have to get to it. But maybe it'll come up at some point. In his first book, he says the following. It didn't really matter what we expected from life. Right? This is about his experience with his friends in the camps. Didn't really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life, daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and in right conduct. Life ultimately means taking the responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the tasks which it constantly sets for each individual. Now, obviously, there are times in life where you can plan and you can, you know, devise, vision for what you want to do in life, but oftentimes you're dealing with issues. And the way that you deal with issues is itself a process of your own perspective on life, right? It's not really what we expected from life, right? He's saying basically people in the camps were saying, "Oy, woe is to us, this situation." And obviously, it was a difficult situation. But the question is not whether life's going to straighten itself out, but rather whether we're going to straighten life out. And we have to deal with what we get. And this is what he's saying, obviously, in the most terrible of situations, he said that. And then he says, similarly, Dostoevsky once said, that's Crime and Punishment, right? Dostoevsky, said once, "There is only one thing I dread, and that is not to be worthy of my sufferings." That's a really interesting line. Not to be worthy of my sufferings. These words frequently came to my mind after I became acquainted with those martyrs whose behavior in the camp, whose suffering and death bore witness to the fact that the last inner freedom cannot be lost. It can be said that they were worthy of their sufferings. The way they bore their suffering was a genuine inner achievement. It is this spiritual freedom which cannot be taken away that makes life meaningful and purposeful." As if to say, the way that you test one's character is in the extreme examples, is in the extreme situations. And for Frankl, he's speaking to this Tzara V'tzuka point, right? Shlomo HaMelech is saying, you're going to have tzaros, you're going to have problems in life. The question is, to what extent are you also going to have tzuka? What extent are you also going to have the internal stress that comes with those issues? Obviously, much easier said than done, of course. But the way that you deal with them is by building up the character before they come. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech is trying to teach these people. Levias chein hein l'roshecha. If you would build up that structure, that foundation internally, then when the tzara comes, you're not going to have as much of a tzuka. Obviously, again, easier said than done. But that's what Shlomo Melch's warning is to these people that aren't listening to him. So what are these people going to do? They're in this situation. Now they realize they're wrongdoing, right? So what are they going to do? Now they're stuck. Says Shlomo Melch in the next pasuk, source number 12. Az yikra unini velo e'aneh. Yishachar unini velo yimtza unini. Interesting way of saying it, but what is he talking about? Right now, it sounds like Shlomo HaMelech is adopting Hashem's voice, right? Yikra unini means they're going to call out to me, meaning they're going to daven. V'lo ene, Hashem's not going to respond to them. Yishacharunini, which Rashi says, mivakshuni, they're going to They're going to seek me. They're going to be. They're going to seek me out. They're going to want me. V'lo yimtzeunini, but they're not going to find me. That's interesting. What's the difference between those two clauses? The first clause is they're going to call out to me and I'm not going to answer. The second clause is they're going to seek me out, but they're not going to find me.
One is active, one is passive.
One, I'm kind of myself. Good. One, he's kind
of. Okay.
What
do you mean? You're saying from Hashem's perspective.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer you as a person.
Right.
And then you're not going to find me because I want to hide myself.
Okay, okay. Good. I know what you're saying. But I want to say it in a different way. Same thing, but in a different way. So this is how I want to say it. Because Hashem could have said, Yishachrunani va'ani achaveh, and I'm going to be hidden. He doesn't say that. He says, Yikreunani, you're going to call out to me, and I'm not going to answer. But then he says, you're going to seek me out, and you're not going to find me. Right? He doesn't say, I'm going to be hidden. He says, you're not going to find me. This I find very fascinating. There are two approaches to davening. One approach to davening is what we'll call the pratim, right? You ask for something very specific. You say, Hashem, I'm going through this difficulty. I want this, this, and that. There's another kind of davening, which is not necessarily so specific, but is more all-encompassing, which basically says, Hashem, I'm in trouble. I need you. Hashem, I don't know where to turn. I need your help, generally. And when it comes to the second form, although it's more general and less detailed, it could be more significant. Why? Because when we have a problem, when we have an issue, so why are we coming to Hashem to solve the issue? Because we're having the issue. Because it's difficult for us. We want to get out of this difficulty. But in the second kind, we're having a difficulty, but our approach to it is, I need Hashem. Not get me out of this problem, but Hashem, I want to be close to you. I want a relationship with you. I'm seeking you out. A very interesting example of this could be in Shmos, but first let's go to source number 13, which is our own davening, Shema Koleinu. I heard this also from Rabbi Daniel Friedman. He has a fascinating, I think it's even a Hasidish Vart. I don't think this is the literal understanding of Shema Koleinu, but he says the following, Shema Koleinu, etc., etc. Then we say, Umil fanecha malkeinu, and from in front of you, our king, Rekam al tishivenu, don't send us away empty-handed, right? Give us something. So says Rabbi Friedman, I don't know where he got it, he didn't quote from anyone here, but he said, this is not a request of Hashem. This is a description of our relationship with Hashem. We're not saying, give me something. Don't leave me empty-handed. What we're saying is, Rekam al tishivenu. You will not leave me empty-handed because ki ata shomea tefilas amcha Yisrael b'rachamim. It might be that I will be empty-handed, but I won't be empty because I know you're listening. Everyone hears the difference? Rekam al tishivenu doesn't mean don't leave us empty-handed. What it means is I will not be empty-handed because I know you're listening to what I'm saying. I have a relationship with you regardless of whether or not you answer my prayers in the affirmative. I want parnasa. Okay, so tomorrow I don't get the raise. But at least I'm not rekam because I know you heard my davening. You heard my bakasha. You just said no. And when we say rekam al tishivenu ki ata shomea tefilas amcha Yisrael, I know I'm not empty-handed because at the very least I know you're listening to me. But when it comes to what Shlomo HaMelech is saying, Yikreunini velo aneh, not only is Hashem not going to answer, but Yishachrunini velo emtzeunini. You're going to be looking for me and I'm not even going to be available. I'm not even going to be there for you to seek me out. You can't even find me. Rekam will be for these people. Because even if the specifics they don't get, they're also not going to get that relationship. It's also not going to be Shomea Tfilas Amcha Yisrael. Hashem's not going to be there for their relationship that he wants, that they want from him.
So is that the people that only come to Hashem when they want something?
Yeah. Yeah. So look at the following source. This is, I don't mean to pat myself on the back because I only saw it in a book. But in source number 14 is one of my, 14 and 15, one of my Divrei Torah from this past year's Seder, Pesach Seder. We say the pasuk in the Haggadah, "Vayhi v'yamim harabim ahem v'yamas malach Mitzrayim v'yanchu bnei Yisrael min avodah v'yizaku." That it was in those days, right at the beginning of Shmos, the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim, and the king of Mitzrayim passed away. V'yanchu bnei Yisrael, and they sighed, they cried out, min ha'avodah, from the work that they had to do, v'yizaku, and they screamed, they cried out again. Batal shavasam el ha'elokim min ha'avodah, and their pleas to Hashem went up to Hashem, Elohim, from the work that they were doing. So kind of a few different interesting things in this pasuk. But it sounds almost as if, on a very simplistic level, that the pasuk is repeating itself. First it says, Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah v'yizaku, that the Israelites were groaning under the bondage, so they cried out. And then it says, their cry helped because it was from the bondage, right? Why were they crying out? Oh, it was because of the work. You just told me that they were crying out because of the work. Right? It says they cried out because of the work. And then it says their cries went out because of the work. So we know it's from the work. You just told me it was from the work. Why are you telling me again it's from the work? So Rabbi Shmuel Nicholsberg has the following take on this pasuk. I think it's such a beautiful take. Rabbi Shmuel of Nicholsberg was the Talmud of Rav Noam Elimelech. No, not Rav Noam Elimelech. I wrote Rav Noam Elimelech here. Was he Rav Noam Elimelech? I want to say he was a student of the Maggid of Mezrich, even though my notes here say the Noam Elimelech. I think I'm wrong. I think my previous self was wrong, and I think he was a Talmud of the Maggid. He and his brother, he had a famous brother also, the Hafla, who was the chief rabbi of Frankfurt am Main, which is very interesting because that's a very yeshivish place. Right, it's very misnagdish a place. So his brother, I'm pretty sure I'm getting the right guy. His brother became the head of a misnagid city, even though he was also a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezrich. And Rav Shmelka became a Talmud of the Maggid. He became the Rav of a Hasidish town in Nicholsburg. So it's kind of interesting that at the beginning of Hasidus, most of the students of early Hasidic literature are both. They're both misnagdim and Hasidim. Right, the real problems only come up really in their generation in terms of fighting the battles with the Vilna Gaon. They say that Rav Shmelka actually went with the Baal HaTanya, with Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. They went to the Vilna Gaon to meet the Vilna Gaon. People know the story? In whatever that was, 1771 or whatever. And they go to the Vilna Gaon and they want to meet the Vilna Gaon. They knock on the door and the Shamash says, sorry, the Vilna Gaon doesn't want to meet with you. This is after the Vilna Gaon put out a very fiery letter against the Hasidim, saying that we shouldn't have anything to do with them. Why he wrote that as a whole arichas for another time. But they say, the Hasidim half of the argument says, that if Rav Shmelka and Rav Baal HaTanya would have been able to meet with the Vilna Gaon at that meeting in 1771, would have brought Mashiach right away. If they would have been able to bring the Jewish people together in that meeting. But the Vilna Gaon refused, he denied them, and they never met each other. But this is the same Rav Shmelka of Nicholsburg. Rav Shmelka says the following on this source, on source number 14 of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. If you look at the pasuk very closely, it's true, it sounds like it's repeating itself. But there are two things going on. Number one, Vayeyanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. They cried out from the work. And then it says Vayizaku. And then it says that they screamed. Right? So there is the screaming or the davening from the work, and then there's just the screaming. It doesn't have anything connected to it, right? That's the first clause. Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. They cried. They groaned from the work. And then vayizaku. And then they cried out to Hashem. And if you notice, the second clause also has two things. Vatal shavasam el elokim min ha'avodah. Says Rav Shmelka. Vatal shavasam elokim. The crying out that they had, which was directed only to Hashem, that was greater, min ha'avodah, greater than the one that they cried out for the work. I don't know if people can appreciate the nuance in the wording there, but it's a play on the word min. Sometimes the word min means from, sometimes it means greater than. So here he's saying, when they cried out to Hashem, that crying out was greater than the crying out of the work. We said that for the beginning of the pasuk had two cries out also. One cry was from the work, and then it just says that they cried. What was that second cry? So it's what we're talking about here. There's a crying which is specific to what you're going through. I want this difficulty to go away. Hashem, please take this away. And then there's another crying, which is, Hashem, I need you. Hashem, I want to be close to you. And says Rosh Melka, that's what the Pasuk is telling us. The crying out that they had, which was only for Hashem, is greater than the crying out that they had for the work. Batal Shavasam Elohim min ha'avoda. That crying out was greater for Hashem, was greater for them than the crying out that was just because of the work. And in this situation, Shlomo Melech is talking about, these people are crying out because they're in a foxhole. They're just up a creek without a paddle. They say, Hashem, we need you to take us out of this thing. We got ourselves in a big mess, and now we need someone to bail us out. So Hashem says, no. Shlomo Melech says, Hashem's not going to help them. He's not going to be the one to take you out of this situation because you wouldn't listen to Shlomo Melech when he was teaching you beforehand, before you got yourself into the situation. He warned you this was going to happen, and you didn't listen. For us, hopefully we won't, you know, deny the rebuke or the advice that we get. But for these people, they were explicitly denying it.
You didn't put that into any. What difference does...
Well, because the new king came and made the work harder. Yeah, that's what the Midrash says over there, yeah. Lastly, to finish off the parak, Vayochlu mipri darkam. And they will eat the fruit of their ways. Yisba'u. And they will have the fill of their own counsels. Shlomo Melech is clearly saying here, you reap what you sow. You are eating your own crops. Shlomo Melech is saying, I tried to tell you, I tried to help you, you decided on your own to go down this path, now you're going to eat the fruit of your labor. Right? Or your lack of labor. Right? Vayochlu mipri darkam, you're going to eat the fruit of your ways. That really, our decisions are up to ourselves, right? That's the beauty, that's the double-edged sword of free will. On the one hand, it allows us to do things. On the other hand, it allows us to do the bad things. So that's what it says here. Ki mishuvas b'sam tar game, v'shavas k'sum ta'abdeim. From the tranquility of the simple, it will kill them. And the complacency of the dullards will destroy them. Right? They want to do nothing. I saw a wonderful t-shirt. Yerachmiel's got a great t-shirt on today, but we won't say it out loud. But I saw a wonderful t-shirt once I was visiting at one of these Jewish camps. And I saw a kid who was wearing their t-shirt. He says, he happened to be playing on a video game in his bed, which is very apropos of the t-shirt. The t-shirt said, I'm not lazy, I just love doing nothing. I don't know if people can relate to that. There's a lot of chachma to it. Not lazy, I just love doing nothing. There's real chachma there. And the Shlomo Melech is saying the same thing here. These people, what do they want? Mishuvas pisayim taragim v'shalvas kasilim ta'abdeim. What's going to be their end? The fact that they want tranquility. They just want to sit back on a hammock and do nothing all day. Right? The tranquility of the simple will kill them. The complacency of the dullards will destroy them. They just want to sit back and do nothing. What's the problem? The next pasuk is a problem. What does the next pasuk say? V'shomeali, those that listen to me, yishkan betach, v'shanan mipachad ra, those who listen to me will dwell in safely, untroubled by terror and misfortune. So what do they get? They get tranquility. So both of these people want tranquility. Right? The evil people want tranquility, the good people want tranquility. So what's the difference between them? Shlomo Melech says, those who want tranquility, they're going to be killed, they're going to die, they're going to have, you know, bad things come to them. But these people, you're guaranteeing them tranquility. So, which one is it? Is tranquility good or is it not good? So Rabbi Friedman had his own take on this. I don't know if he quoted anyone. But he said, there's a difference between the two because it matters what you do beforehand. Of course, tranquility might be the end game for many people. They want to be comfortable, they want to be unbothered, untroubled, as this translation says. The question is, what have you done to earn that tranquility? These people want to do nothing because they love doing nothing. They want the tranquility because they want to sit back and they don't want to do any work. I have someone here. Let's see who says it. Rabbeinu Yonah says over here, Ritzon olomar mashabachru lasheves b'hasheket umargoa mibli torayach. They want to just sit back, do nothing without any effort. That's the kicker. They want to sit back and do nothing. But what is the tranquility that Shlomo Melech promises? Those that are shomeali, those that want to put the work in, those that want to actually do the work, put in the effort, and become better people, do what Hashem wants, So then Yishkol Nevetach, they're going to be able to have the security. They're going to have the sha'anan. They're going to have the respite that they're looking for. I think Rashi says that sha'anan means shalva. It's mamash the same word. Sha'anan, the shalva of the ksil, is going to be their end. But sha'anan is going to come to the tzaddik. Rashi says, sha'anan, vihi shaliyo v'sheket. It's going to be their tranquility and their peace and quiet. They're going to get the same thing, but only after they put the work in. And maybe people recognize this, that the greatest feeling of rest comes after you work really hard, right? You can't really rest if you didn't work beforehand. I mean, you can, but you're just being lazy. You're just continuing doing nothing. Says Shlomo Melech, the only real worthwhile rest, the worthwhile tranquility, is when it comes after a good hard day's work. And it's the same thing in a religious sense. Hashem will reward you with tranquility when you put the work in. If you're not going to put the work in, so then it's going to end up being a shalva that's going to lead to problems. The Midrash tells us, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz migurei aviv, that Yaakov Avinu wanted to sit, and he wanted to be Yeshev. He wanted to have a place, be'eretz migurei aviv. What does Rashi say there? Bikesh Yaakov lasheves b'shalva. He wanted to have some tranquility, just wanted to sit down and relax for a little bit. He had all these tsaros of Yaakov, of Esav, the running away, and then of Rachel and Leah trying to get a wife. All these tsaros. All he wanted to do by Yeshev Yaakov, he wanted to sit and do nothing. He wanted to just be tranquil for a little bit. Says Rashi, what happened? Baal of Rogzo Shel Yosef comes along the Yosef story and throws him back into the whirlwind. Right? The Yosef story that picks up right where he left off with all of his troubles. Because if you just want to sit without doing the work, so then obviously Yaakov is in a different situation, of course. But Shlomo Melech is basically saying, shalva is okay, but only if you're first Shomei Ali. Only if you're first going to listen to what I'm telling you, put the effort in, then you can really rest after a good hard day's work or a good religious workout also. That hopefully Hashem will reward you with the shalva you're looking for, and in that way, you'll be able to yishkan levetach, you'll be have that security forever that Hashem will grant you because of your efforts. So that's the end of Perek Aleph. Already got through a full Perek. Mirtz Hashem, next week we'll continue Monday night, 8 o'clock, with Perek Beis. Thanks for coming.